Today you'll hear analysis out of the IEA's Brexit unit, led by our chief economist, Julian Jessop. The cost of a divorce bill has been estimated to be anywhere between 0 to 100 billion euro. Digital officer Madeline Grant asked Julian to give his analysis of what a fair payment might be. The two also discuss what legal ramifications there could be to this payment and what would happen if there were no payment made at all. If you like what you hear, be sure to visit the Brexit Unit section of our website at iea.org.uk.
So we're here today to talk about the potential divorce bill with the EU. But my question is, I mean, we're leaving the EU. Why do we owe them a penny?
Well, I think that's a very good question. And arguably, under Article 50, our obligations under the European treaties run out no later than March 2019. So arguably, all our financial obligations should end too. And there's a strong legal opinion, actually, would be on very firm ground if we did decide to walk away without paying a penny. The problem with that, of course, is that it may well prove to be bad politics. We are trying to negotiate the best possible deal for our future long-term relationship with the European Union. If we don't come to an amicable compromise on the so-called exit bill, then I think we'll be putting the whole negotiations at risk.
Well, a number of figures have been thrown around about, you know, the potential sums of money involved here. The highest that I've heard so far, though I'm sure it could well increase as time goes on, the upper limit of that was 100 billion euros. And on the other hand, despite your talk of good politics, many Brits would consider zero to be the appropriate sum of money. Is there a potential sweet spot between those two sums to be met?
I think it's helpful to go back to first principles and think about why we might have to pay an exit bill in the first place. I mean, one way of thinking about this is it's like a divorce, where what you do is you split up the assets and liabilities and share those out between the two parties. But I think the situation here is a little bit different. After all, the European Union will continue to exist after we've left, and indeed it began well before we joined. I think this is more like ending the membership of a club. So the question is, how long is our subscription going to run? And there is a case for arguing that our subscription runs not until 2019, but a little bit later, until 2020, which is when the EU's current multi-year budgetary process ends. So I think there's a reasonable case for arguing we should continue to pay our fees until the end of that 2020 period. However, the European Union has gone a lot further than this, and this is where the much bigger numbers come from. They're arguing, for example, that we should continue to contribute to spending that will take place long after our departure, including to big payments to farmers in countries like Poland as part of the Common Agricultural Policy, and big structural funds as well to some of the other poorer countries within the European Union. They're also asking for big upfront payments for so-called contingent liabilities, which is what might be due if certain countries default on loans, and various other bits and pieces they've chucked in as well. So they've come up with a bill of well over 100 billion. Whereas my much simpler policy of paying our membership fees until the end of 2020 would produce a bill nearer 30 billion euros or perhaps 26 billion pounds.
So that would simply be tying up our obligations until the end of this EU budget. How likely do you think the EU would be to accept that scenario you described? Because recent weeks have seen EU members hardening their position. Early reports suggest that some member states have piled on additional demands. As you mentioned, the Polish farm subsidy. Also, France has been putting on similar pressure for increased farming subsidies, which again goes well past 2020. And with the current political turmoil in Britain, is there perhaps a case that they're sort of capitalising on the situation in British politics right now?
I think there's no doubt that our negotiating position is weaker now than it was before the general election was called. So in that sense, the European partners negotiating with us will doubtless feel that they're in a better position to ask for more money. But they have to be careful here because, as I said earlier, there's always a possibility of us walking away without a penny. And a lack of a trade deal would hurt them as well as hurting us. So they need to be careful what they ask for. There's a broader context here, which is that they must accept that we are leaving. So at some point, there needs to be some form of fiscal discipline imposed on the EU budget. It may well come a bit sooner than many of the European countries would like, but they need to recognise that the current levels of spending are not sustainable when one of the biggest net contributors is leaving. So there is going to be some horse trading here. I suspect that we will come to some sort of compromise, hopefully far nearer the numbers that I'm suggesting, rather than those that some European countries are proposing. proposing. But at the end of the day, it's important to remember that the UK can walk away without paying a penny.
So the 100 billion, I'm not sure exactly the specifics of how that figure has been calculated, but is it based on any kind of rational footing?
Well, at face value, it does look completely outrageous. And we remember that our normal net contributions to the European Union are typically of the order of, say, £10 billion a year. So we're talking here of a number potentially 10 times as much as that, 10 years of contributions as a price for leaving. And I don't think anybody would think that that was sensible. If their gym or their golf club presented that bill to them for leaving, they'd say it's absolutely outrageous. But the way the numbers have been put together is a sort of certain logic to them. It's worth stressing that 100 billion plus is a gross figure. We would get some of that money back at some point in the future in the form of EU spending in the UK or rebates that we normally get anyway on our contributions, or indeed repayment on loans that we've made as a member participating in the European Investment Bank. So even that 100 billion is probably more like 70 when you net off those payments that will be coming back to us at some point in the future. But given a starting point where we have the option of walking away and paying zero, I think the idea that we're ever going to be willing to pay as much as 100 is completely outrageous. And I'm sure we're going to settle for a figure far nearer the 30-odd that I think is justified on the basis of our membership contributions over the next couple of years.
So it's a kind of highball figure that you would expect at the start of negotiations?
That's absolutely right. I mean, I mentioned zero as the lowest number we might be willing to pay. Of course, there are some people who are arguing we should actually get a rebate for our past contributions, either because we haven't got proper value for money for them, or because we should be getting back some share of the assets that the European Union, either as an institution or as a selection of countries, has built up over the years as a result of our contributions. I think that argument is going too far. And normally when you leave a club, you don't expect to take half the changing rooms with you or some of the equipment that you paid for. So I think on that basis, zero is probably the lower bound. But this is a negotiation. Both sides will set out extreme positions to begin with. I would be hopeful that we'll compromise on something sensible within the next few months, at least in terms of setting out some principles that allow us to move on to things actually ultimately in the long term are going to be more important concerning our long-term future economic relationship with the rest of the European Union.
So let's say that the EU has and continues to overplay their hand in that respect, and Britain follows up on your recommendations and decides to leave without a penny. Some would say that's the worst case scenario, departure with no deal. What would happen then?
Well, there are different types of no deal. There's certainly a catastrophic outcome where we leave in a position of chaos, where business and consumer confidence in the UK is hit very hard. At that point, we'll probably be sliding into recession. Trade with the rest of the European Union would come to a complete halt. And potentially there might be all sorts of damage from the breakdown of other relationships, important relationships we have with Europe over things like atomic energy, security cooperation, flights and so on and so on. But I think that's very much a worst case scenario. I think that's unlikely. I think a more credible no deal scenario is one where we fall back on existing relationships that the European Union has with the rest of the world. For example, the so-called WTO trade rules, where we continue with our close cooperation on things like security and provision of atomic energy and so on and so on. In that scenario, things are a little bit more difficult than they are now. Clearly, trade will have more frictions than it does now. We'll probably be paying tariffs that we don't currently pay, going through customs checks that we don't currently have. But even then, we will still have benefits. We will be able to deregulate the economy. We'll be able to sign free trade deals with the rest of the world very quickly. So although there will be some downsides from that scenario, it wouldn't be the end of the world. After all, we'd continue to have access to the single market, even if it isn't on quite the same principles, without tariffs and without borders that it has now.